This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Later in the show, we talk with Tanis Rideout about her new novel, The Sea Between Two Shores. It's about two families, one Canadian and one from an island in Vanuatu, who must deal with the legacy of colonialism in the South Pacific and the responsibilities they have to each other. But first, Ava Chin tells us about her stunning family memoir / history of the Chinese Exclusion Act in America, Mott Street. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ava Chin's writing studio is in the same building on Mott Street in New York City's Chinatown, where her forebears lived for generations, on both sides of the family. But she grew up estranged from her father and his family, raised by her mother and maternal grandparents. Her drive to find out more about her father and his family led her on an odyssey of discovery that had relevance far beyond the circle of her family. It illustrated the whole history of Chinese immigration to the U.S., a history of exploitation and exclusion, as well as the Chinese community's long struggle against injustice. Chin relates this history in her spellbinding new book, Mott Street, A Chinese-American Family Story of Exclusion and Homecoming. Ava Chin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's so good to be here with you.
I love this book. I want to say right up at the front that it was an absolutely terrific read. It read like a novel. And maybe we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about how you were able to reconstruct what happened, the whole history of your family over a period of time. But before we do that, I actually want to ask you about the subtitle, A Chinese-American Family's History of Exclusion and Homecoming. Those are two almost opposite concepts. The exclusion refers not just to a general phenomenon, but to the specific law, the Chinese Exclusion Act. And it provides a framework for the book. Tell us a little bit about your own personal relationship to that act, your thinking about it, how that motivated you to do this book.
Yeah, the subtitle is A Chinese-American Family's Story of Exclusion and Homecoming. And exclusion was the frame for the book. When I set about working on this book, I was really thinking that I was trying to uncover our family's story. So just a little bit of background. I was raised by a single mother and loving Chinese-American grandparents, but I was estranged from an entire side of my family. My parents' divorce was so acrimonious that I never saw them together in the same room. And so I didn't know my father growing up as a child. I didn't meet him until I was in my 20s. And by that point, I also knew that the family that raised me, from the family that raised me, that I was a descendant of a Chinese railroad worker who had helped build the nation's first transcontinental railroad, which was the apparatus that at least physically united the country after the Civil War. And what I realized growing up is that these stories that I heard about the railroad and our contributions to it weren't being taught in schools. In fact, when I was in grade school and I learned about the Transcontinental Railroad, I was shocked to see the official photograph of the completion of the railroad, and there wasn't a single Chinese or Asian face in the photograph. And I knew that there was something wrong, right? I knew that there was like this hole, that something was missing. But I didn't discover the idea of, or the actual laws of Chinese exclusion until much later, until I was in college. And I learned about it in literature. But it was sort of the elephant that was in the room in terms of when folks got together, family members got together, And when we met other Chinese people who had as long roots in America as we did, I found out that my family members all lived during this 61-year period where Chinese people were not allowed to come in legally into the country, and they were prevented from becoming citizens for over 60 years. And so the idea of exclusion all of a sudden started to really loom large with me when I realized that both sides of my family were living in New York during much of that time period, that the reason why they were in New York in the first place was because the discriminatory anti-Chinese sentiment that was really popular, enormously popular at the time, and had helped to create Chinese exclusion in the first place, had fomented into these anti-Chinese pogroms, or these pushing out of Chinese people from the West Coast and from Idaho. And so a lot of people, this is in the 19th century, in the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s, folks had to make a decision, since they were pushed out of the places out west that they were living. They had to make a decision about where they were going to live. And my family members, most of them, ended up jumping on the same train that my forebears helped to create and rode that train out further east to New York, where they wound up living in the same neighborhood, in the same tenement apartment building, in the heart of the community on Mott Street.
And where you live today, is that right?
I do not live on Mott Street, but I'm lucky enough that I have a writing studio there. And it's a wonderful place because it's where so many generations of both sides of my family were born and raised.
And so your family was excluded by the Chinese Exclusion Act, and you were excluded by half of your family, your father's half of the family. Now let's talk about homecoming. What is the meaning of that in the title of this book, Mott Street?
I think that the homecoming is multifaceted. The homecoming is the discovery of this place, this particular building in New York's Chinatown, where both sides of my family lived as upstairs, downstairs neighbors from each other, decades and generations before I was born. The homecoming is, I think, a sense of, you know, that embrace of home that a neighborhood and a community can really give to you. I think for so long, I felt very excluded from my family because I did not know an entire side of my family. But to realize that, in fact, both sides of my family had known each other for generations as upstairs, downstairs neighbors from each other, as members of the same Boy Scout troops, as members of the same churches and schools, as neighbors, both in Chinatown, as well as there was a certain point in time in which they summered together out on the Jersey Shore, and they became neighbors once they became homeowners and bought up houses out there too. So the sense of homecoming for me is really tangible as it relates to this building and this community that was a refuge for us all during this very, very difficult period in American history. You know, one of the wonderful things about being connected in this way and being able to trace my roots back to this building is that the building has really felt like a refuge for the entire family. You know, this was the place where they could feel at home. And the fact that I have a connection to the building, it just means the world to me. And I can, you know, bring that story and teach these lessons of this legacy of resilience as my family members both try to fight the Chinese Exclusion Act laws. They coalition build. you know, with other communities. In the late 19th century, early part of the 20th century, that was astounding to me, you know, that the fact that they were so disenfranchised here, but they still reached out to other communities. They still helped other communities, when other communities became refugees in other parts of the world.
Yeah, in fact, you write, I mean, this was something I didn't know. You write about 1903, which is when my family, Russian Jews, came over from the Russian-Polish border because of the pogroms, came to the Lower East Side of New York, not far from where your family came. And the Chinese citizens, your family, in fact, mobilized support for the Jews who were fleeing persecution in Russia. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so that to me was totally fascinating. So you're right, the time period was 1903. And in this period, it was the first pogroms of the 20th century. It was the Kishinev pogroms. It was often called the shot that was heard around the world. And folks really mobilized. Fundraisers were done throughout the Jewish communities, the diaspora, certainly throughout the United States. And the call went out, it was in the newspapers, the call went out here in New York that money needed to be raised to help these refugees. And it was an interesting period in time for Chinatown because it was the same period, it was a year after Chinese exclusion was made permanent. And so all the organizing work that my family members had done to try to fight exclusion landed for them in naught, in the sense that they were not able to prevent the continuation of Chinese exclusion. But they continued to fight for our civil rights, and they were deeply interested in helping out other people. And I think the fact that, you know, Chinatown is part of the Lower East Side. And the fact that, you know, a lot of their neighbors were Jewish and they had been already building bridges with their neighbors in the Jewish Lower East Side and also courting different politicians at the time period. New York City politicians, Tammany Hall was the dominant force in New York City at the time. And there were Jewish politicians as well. You know, the Jewish politicians were some of the first and the few to speak out against Chinese exclusion. I think because there was probably a feeling and an understanding that if exclusion could happen to Chinese people, the next step might be to Jewish people as well, right? So I think it was in folks' best interests to work together. And other writers from the Ford newspaper have written about this. But I think it was actually, it goes much deeper than that, because my great uncle and others like him had survived this great pushing out, these pogroms against Chinese out west. Once he made it to New York and was able to establish himself as a merchant and was able to be, you know, he couldn't become a citizen, but he was able to become prosperous. He wanted to help out other people as well. And I think the great takeaway was not just in what my family members were able to do to help Jewish refugees in the time period. It was also significant, the fact it was newsworthy. So there were headlines in the English language press. And they were, the headlines were things like Chinese help Jews or Chinese go out for Jews, right? And it was newsworthy and noteworthy for a lot of English language readers, because what happened was they were so shocked by this that a lot of Christians around the country decided, well, if Chinese people were helping Jewish people, well, we really need to be doing that too, right? And so heads of certain very large Jewish congregations mentioned this. They're like, yeah, you know, now because of these fundraisers, now Christians across the country have been like sending donations to us as well. So this was nothing short, I think, of astounding even for me to uncover.
Yeah, it's just a great story. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with journalist and author Ava Chin about her new book, Mott Street, A Chinese American Family Story of Exclusion and Homecoming. And this book is filled with the most memorable characters. You've already mentioned one, Deck Foon. I mean, both sides of your family were larger than life. But tell us a little bit about Deck Foon and also his wife, Elva Lisk. I mean, what a remarkable story.
Yes. So when Deck Foon comes into the country, it's a couple of years after the establishment of exclusion. And he comes because there are, you know, China at the time in the 19th century had suffered through the Opium Wars with the West, Great Famine, a revolutionary war that kills, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And so Deck Foon and other men like him came out when they were in their 20s. They came to America because they needed to provide money for their families. And unfortunately, the American laws also made it really difficult for Asian women to come over. So Deck Foon could not bring his wife and his son. So he was forced to be separated from them. The wife passes away when the son is in grade school. And Deck Foon makes a decision that it's better for the son to stay in China and to get a good private school education than to come here in America, where sometimes, this is not the case in New York, but in other parts of the country, sometimes the Chinese children were not able to go to school with the other children, right? Because of segregation. So he decided that it was better that his son stay in China and get a good education there. And he continued to work. So because of exclusion, by the way, he does not get to meet his son again, who he left when he was a toddler, until the son was in his 20s. So in this period, Deck Foon is living in New York. He is part of a very progressive Christian, Chinese Christian community in New York City. And he meets Elva Lisk, who was born in Pennsylvania, the daughter of a Civil War veteran. And Elva, Aunt Elva, is harboring a secret that we won't talk about that here, right? That will be something that the readers can read about. But Aunt Elva's secret actually, in effect, destroys her first marriage. And so by the time Aunt Elva and Uncle Deck meet, they are both older, they are mature individuals, and they have both suffered from the loss of a partner in some way, shape, or form. Their love story to me is one of the most interesting central moments in the book. They are central characters in the book. They were so important to my grandmother's family, my maternal grandmother's family. It was such a pleasure to learn about them and to write about them. I think one of the interesting things for many readers, first of all, Francesca, as you know, because you read the book, there are so many characters, so many decades, so many generations that I deal with, but there's so much interesting hidden knowledge and history that I think a lot of Americans just don't know about. And so I think one of the really interesting things about Aunt Elva is that Aunt Elva lived in a period in time in which, by the way, it was very common for American families to disown their daughters if they married or had relationships outside of their race, right? But her family did not disown her. While they didn't necessarily embrace Uncle Deck, because I think it was difficult for them, right, during this time period, they certainly gave their blessings to the marriage.
But she was abandoned by her country.
Right. So I'm about to get to that. So unfortunately for Aunt Elva, a couple of years after they got married, the government decided that an American woman's citizenship needed to change to reflect that of her husband's. And so what that meant is that some women, if a woman married an English man or an American woman married a German, she became, in the eyes of American law, an English woman or a German woman. And in the case of Aunt Elva and the other white women who married into these interracial marriages, Aunt Elva became, in the eyes of the law, a Chinese. She would not have realized that this happened. Most American women did not realize they had lost their citizenship until many years later, when women finally got the right to vote and women registered to vote. Aunt Elva received the rejection that she could not, in fact, vote because she was not considered an American anymore.
This is just so incredible. And I mean, this was discriminatory against any woman who married outside her quote unquote race, but it was even more draconian for women who married Chinese immigrants.
That's right. That's right. Because Chinese were not allowed in that period to naturalize and become citizens. So I don't even know. I don't think Aunt Elva actually got her citizenship back because I think she passed away before she would have been able to do it.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ava Chin about her book, Mott Street, A Chinese American Family's History of Exclusion and Homecoming. It's really fascinating, this story. So I want to go back a little bit more to the Exclusion Act and kind of the different permutations it went through. It started as bad, but it actually got worse as time went on. And so I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the trajectory of this act and why did it become more restrictive, even more restrictive over time? And in fact, why did it come about to begin with?
Yeah. And all really great questions. So let me contextualize. In the 1870s, after the completion of the railroad, with the railroad, of course, you had many Chinese workers, Chinese laborers who built the most arduous, the most difficult part of the railroad through the Sierra Nevadas, right? Out in California. And this is the period in time in which my family members came and worked on the railroad. After the completion of the railroad, several things happened, including there was overspeculation on the railroad and a run on banks. And for the first time, Wall Street had to be shut. So the country enters a great economic depression. In fact, they called it the Great Depression before the Great Depression of the 20th century. So during that period in time, there were European immigrants on the East Coast, white Americans on the East Coast, who, searching for jobs, jumped upon that railroad and headed out west. What they discovered out west were Chinese people, Chinese men in manufacturing jobs that they thought should be rightfully theirs. So the anti-Chinese sentiment at the time was incredibly popular. It was so popular that politicians used it as a platform in order to get votes. So this is a period in time in which the country is in the era of Reconstruction. And in that time period, it should have been a moment of great reform. But unfortunately for us, it was a moment of deep entrenchment. What you got was West Coast politicians working hand in hand with Southern politicians who were intent upon maintaining supremacy. And they worked together to cut deals to enact the country's first restrictive immigration legislations against Chinese people. And so, you know, this is a very, very difficult time for being Chinese. And this is a difficult time that my family remembers for being Chinese as well. So Chinese exclusion is put on the books in 1882. And it doesn't stop until 1943, during World War II, when our country needed an ally with China against Japan. And the reasons why Chinese exclusion, basically every 10 years, it kept needing to be renewed. And instead of it just being the same old renewals, there were tighter and tighter restrictions, more paperwork. It was a greater rigmarole that Chinese people at the time had to cut through in order to come here or to remain. And what was happening at the same time in our country, unfortunately, was that this dovetailed into the period in the rise of eugenics. So eugenics, you'll remember, you know, I'm not an expert in eugenics, but that was a period in time in which scientists and social scientists were trying to apply the scientific method to the idea of the betterment of the race. Of course, all of this is completely subjective. And what ends up happening is we get a lot of like truly horrible things happening, right, in this country. Forced sterilization of women out in California. The eugenics movement in this country was so popular amongst philanthropists, academics, politicians, you know, incredibly wealthy people, that it becomes a kind of a shining star and a beacon for other people outside the country. And you're probably aware, Francesca, that Nazis in Germany really looked at the American eugenics movement as something to really aspire to.
Yeah.
We can only laugh because it's so horrible, right? In recognition of how horrible this is. So at the same time, our country is scrutinizing its borders. It starts with Chinese folks, and then it becomes more stringent in 1917 and 1924. And in those periods, almost all Asians are excluded from coming into the country. And then there are restrictions against Southern and Eastern Europeans as well.
Yeah. And, you know, it was also a time of great repression against the labor movement, and also a time of a huge amount of racial terror exercised on African Americans. So it's all kind of a piece. But there was one thing that kind of blew a hole in the wall of Chinese exclusion, and that was a San Francisco earthquake. Talk about what happened and also how that impacted your own family.
So during this time period, right before 1906, Chinese people had a really difficult time getting into the country. When the laws are that restrictive, people will find a way to come in, and they will circumnavigate the laws as best they can, unfortunately. And so what happens, though, is that in 1906, in April of 1906, the great San Francisco earthquake occurs. And the shocks are felt all the way from Oregon, all the way down to Los Angeles, but they also spark these great fires throughout the city of San Francisco. And one of the things that catches fire is the city hall and the records building. And in those records buildings were the birth certificates and death certificates of countless San Franciscans. What that meant was that when Chinese people came to the border and were scrutinized by and interrogated by immigration officials, what Chinese people could now say was, well, actually, I was born in San Francisco. My records were in the city hall, which burnt down, right? And by birthright citizenship, as we know, when you're born in America, when you're born in the U.S., you have citizenship, right? So that's what they said, right? It wasn't necessarily the truth.
And these were paper families that actually allowed some of your own relatives to come over. Is that right?
That's right. So my grandfather, who was the grandson of the railroad builder, was able to come in during World War II when a lot of Chinese people were fleeing the country because it was occupied by the Japanese army. My grandfather bought papers to allow him to come into the country. He got stuck in detention for 3 months. He was 16 years old, but those papers enabled him to eventually be released. And he makes his way out to New York, where he meets my grandmother. And it's a whirlwind relationship. And there's a lot of there with their relationship as well.
And there are so many countless stories in this this book that just read so well. Now, how were you able to reconstruct dialogue? I mean, I know some of it was imagined, but you did a huge amount of research for this book.
Yeah. So I do mention in the foreword that I was not present when people were having, you know, their conversations. That's why a lot of the dialogue part, and I put that in quotes, is actually in italics. How I reconstructed these scenes was through doing an enormous amount of research. These stories were based on stories that I heard in childhood. They're based on interviews that I conducted with different family members throughout the decades. They're also constructed from documents, written documents that my family members left behind that I often found after they had long since passed away. So there were the family documents and the interviews, but there was also the research that I did outside the boundaries of the family. I won a Fulbright to China. And in 2017, I took my family with me and we moved to China for the semester so that I could do the research in our villages. And there I was able to collect genealogy documents, many of which had narratives attached to them, narratives about important members of the family. Sometimes I was really lucky and it pertained to, you know, our branch or somebody that I had heard about. And I was also able to interview the villagers who remembered the family members. I was actually astonished. I went to Dek Fun's village, which was also my great-grandfather's village. And I asked them questions and they all remembered. They didn't remember Dek Fun as much, but they definitely remembered my great-grandfather. And my great-grandfather had left China in the late 1890s. So
that's remarkable.
Yeah, but they remembered him and they remembered the things that he had did during World War II, like to help the cause against, you know, Japanese invasion. So people's memories were long and it was a wonderful thing to do the research of this book. And there were also there were documents that are in Chinese that I was able to obtain when I was in China. There was even, you know, with the fundraisers for the pogrom victims, you know, I even had to do research in Yiddish language newspapers. So I was aided by numerous translators.
Oh, that's great. So I want to also make the link to today, because you make it in this book, Mott Street, Ava Chin. We've seen a terrifying resurgence of anti-AAPI hate. My daughter-in-law is Japanese, and she's talked to me about how frightened. She was living in New York, and now she's living upstate New York, where she feels even more frightened. She feels that people, you know, look at her strangely. And it's impacted your life as well, not to speak of that we have a huge amount of anti-immigrant hysteria, not just towards AAPI people, but, you know, people in general. Talk about how this has impacted your life and draw the connections for us.
Yeah. So when I was working on the book, I was coming down to Chinatown and it was right around the time of the pandemic. And I witnessed the ways in which Chinatown was deeply impacted under the pandemic. Businesses were shuttered because people were too afraid to come down here. And then there was the rise in anti-Asian violence that was certainly perpetuated by the anti-Chinese rhetoric that our last president was espousing. It was terrifying and really sobering to realize that, you know, I'm a fifth generation New Yorker, and New York was the one place where I really feel at home. But I've had friends who have been attacked, and the attacks have made it on the evening news. And it's very sobering and disheartening to see this happening. On the other hand, this is something that was not unfamiliar to my family. And within our family history in America, it appeared as if the rise in violence, you know, coincided with COVID. But I believe that the roots of the violence, the seeds of it, really were sown in the mid-19th century with the establishment of Chinese exclusion. It's just that people don't know that history or have simply forgotten it.
And they will learn that history in reading your book, Mott Street. I highly recommend it to my listeners. It was just a terrific read. A Chinese American Family's History of Exclusion and Homecoming. Ava Chin, it's just been a delight to talk with you. Just fascinating about this book.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Francesca.
Ava Chin is professor of creative nonfiction and journalism at the CUNY Graduate Center. She's the former Urban Forager columnist for the New York Times, and her previous book was Eating Wildly. Read an excerpt from Mott Street by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, two families deal with the legacy of colonialism in the South Pacific. Stay tuned after a short break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the early 1800s, a Nova Scotian couple arrives on the shores of an island in the archipelago of what is now known as Vanuatu to convert the local indigenous peoples. The arrival of these strangers leads to exchange and friction, cooperation and violence, culminating in a catastrophe the missionaries unwittingly unleash on the island. 200 years later in Toronto, the Stuarts are a family locked in mourning after the accidental drowning of their youngest son. When Michelle Stuart receives an unexpected call from an island inviting the Stuarts to participate in a reconciliation ceremony for their respective ancestors, she accepts in a desperate effort to save herself and her family. This is a story that Ta-Nehisi Rideout weaves in her novel, The Sea Between Two Shores. Based loosely on actual events, the book explores how two cultures deal very differently with grief, the tragedies that bind them, and the responsibilities they may hold to each other. Ta-Nehisi Rideout, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So this book, The Sea Between Two Shores, is a story of two families, one indigenous from Vanuatu, the other is Canadian from Toronto, who are connected by events that occurred in the mid-19th century. Tell us about those events and their link to actual history, even though this is a novel.
Yeah, I was lucky enough about 6 years ago now to travel to Vanuatu on vacation and didn't really know much about the place before we went. And, you know, I'd done a little bit of reading in some guidebooks, and sort of one of the first early days that we were there, my husband and I were sitting overlooking the ocean, this little tiny bungalow on an island called Tana. And, you know, people always leave behind their guidebooks and stuff like that when they travel on. I was reading through one, and there was just this little paragraph about some missionaries that had been killed on the island in the mid-1800s. And what struck me, though, was that they were missionaries from Halifax. And my family is from the Canadian Maritimes, not from Nova Scotia, but New Brunswick. And it just, something sort of zapped in my brain a little bit about connecting those two very far apart places, very different places. And I'd been reading a lot about the colonizing of North America and but then sort of recognizing how the colonialism of even the South Pacific was connected to Canada was just sparked something in my brain. And I was like, oh, I wonder if there's something in this. And I didn't really know how to write at that at the time, but it kept, that story just stayed with me about these like two very different places. And somehow, you know, I was connected to both of them. And so I sort of sat with it for a while and then found a story later on after we'd returned about different families on a different island in Vanuatu who had come together to sort of reconcile a similar event, missionaries who had been killed on the island and the descendants of both families coming together in the present day to meet each other and to connect together and to return some things that had been taken from the island at the time. And I was just astounded by that those kinds of things were happening, the ongoingness of history, the presence of this history. And I thought that was a way to kind of tell the story that wasn't just the same version of the story, the first encounter stories that we've heard so many times before, was that how it's still trickling down to people and families today and how closely connected those things still are.
You first wanted to tell the story of the Canadian missionaries, but you later decided to tell it from both sides, and actually with an emphasis on the Indigenous people. I wonder, were you concerned about being seen as doing cultural appropriation, and how did you deal with that?
It's a very important conversation that's ongoing at the moment. I think we will be continuing to have that. When I first, particularly the historical section of the novel, but even the present day section, I think I started initially writing from the white character's points of view and feeling much more comfortable with that. But then sort of realizing that by doing that, it was also leaving out a lot of voices that I thought were important to the story. And so I tried to approach it thoughtfully and meaningfully and sort of interrogated myself about why I wanted to be telling this story and what it meant for me, and read as much as I could, but then also reached out to a number of Ni Vanuatu people who helped me out by reading various drafts of the novel, and other readers sort of throughout Oceania as well. And I'm sure that I have gotten some things wrong, and I'm sure that there are probably some readers who will still take exception to my having written the novel. And I think that's okay. I think we're trying to find a way to move through this and hear different stories and hear different voices that we haven't heard. But I also think it's important for white writers like myself to wrestle with ideas about race and colonization and those kinds of things, not leave them or expect them to be taken up by writers of color or Indigenous writers. And yeah, it's a really important conversation. I also kind of want to be part of that conversation. I don't want to shy away from the big questions in the literary world these days.
And why were the missionaries killed in the actual historical event? And what led to one of them being killed in this novel?
I think that we're always like questioning why particular missionaries were killed at particular spots. There was a great line I came across, and it's one of the epigraphs in the book of all this made sense to someone. And when I read that, or I guess it was an audiobook I was listening to at the time, that really stopped me, because there are such very different cultures, and like, even if you're sort of working with the best of intentions to reach towards each other, there must have just been so many misapprehensions and miscommunications between these people who barely spoke the same. Like, they were learning the language and the customs and all of this stuff, and obviously coming with their own baggage on both sides of cultural ideas. And so I think that in most instances, it was probably an utter misunderstanding of having committed some kind of taboo.
Except there is a nefarious intention behind what happened. Some white men come, not the missionaries. They want to exploit the wood, and they end up deliberately infecting the local people with measles. And this is based on an actual history. Is that correct?
Yeah, certain things like that did absolutely happen, kind of disconnected from sort of the original instigating idea. But yeah, and I guess that's what I mean about like the misapprehension, is that it wasn't the missionaries who end up being killed in the novel weren't the ones who actually committed those acts, but they're associated with these people, which they should be associated with those people, but they're connected much more strongly by the Ni Vanuatu people, and for various other sort of things and missteps that have occurred kind of along the way. So yeah, so the sailors who come in are kind of this like last thing that sets it off and gives this actual sort of moment of violence, the spark. But things are already crumbling some by the time they get there.
And one of the reasons they're crumbling, it strikes me, is, and it's interesting because we hear the voices of the, I guess it's Ni Vanuatu people in the 19th century track. We hear their response, their reaction to the missionaries. We don't hear the missionaries themselves, but it's pretty clear that the missionaries are, you know, it's not just goodwill. I mean, they're coming from a position of overweening arrogance and really contempt for the local culture, whereas the local culture is trying to welcome them. So there's not really an equality of goodwill between the two, it seems.
Yeah, I think that within the context of the time, this is not to excuse behavior of colonizers by any stretch of the imagination, but as a novelist, you know, you kind of have to put yourself in everybody's head as much as possible. And so I think like, and I think William is a particularly terrible human being, honestly. And I think he's...
And say who William is.
Oh, sorry. William is the missionary who comes with his wife, Josephine. You know, and Josephine, I think, is, you know, more trapped than she would like to be in this place. It's not her choice to have gone to this place. She's sort of dragged along by her husband, who, yeah, is sort of one of the vengeful, what we think of when we think about missionaries. He's angry and he's like, yeah, he's sort of going to save these people for their own good. And it's his responsibility to raise them up and like kind of all of those sorts of things. I think Josephine, on the other hand, is trying to meet the Ni Vanuatu people more where they are. She sits with the women. She tries to learn some of their languages as they're trying to learn hers, whereas her husband has no time or patience for that whatsoever.
So now tell us more about some of the main characters. I mean, since we're on in the 19th century for the moment, tell us about Fania.
Fina.
Yeah, tell us about Fina and the position that she plays within the relationship of the local people to the missionaries.
So initially when I had written the historical section in particular, it was written from Josephine's point of view. And then, you know, in discussions with my editor and sort of trying to figure out the best way to do it, we started splitting it between Josephine and Fina, and then eventually giving it all to Fina. And what I wanted to explore was why somebody would be drawn to these new strangers and like what it changed for them within their own cultural space. And so Fina, who's a young girl, she's, you know, 14 years old or so. And so therefore doesn't have a lot of power in her community. And when she starts engaging with the missionaries, she has a gift for acquiring language and a desire. And suddenly that gives her some new knowledge and therefore some new power. And it starts to change things a little bit for her within her space. She gets to sort of help with communication between her people and the missionaries. And it shifts her position a little bit. And when I sort of first started writing her, I was like, oh, I wonder, like, is this a culturally appropriate character? I was talking with another friend about her, and it's like, you know, she's like this teenage girl in the space. Does this make sense? And she was like, well, there have always been spunky teenage girls throughout history in every culture. And I was like, okay, I think that that's true. And so giving her the space and giving her this desire to like learn and acquire this new knowledge and power gave reason for her to keep returning to the missionaries and keep watching them and studying them and trying to kind of grasp as much as she could, because it gives her a bit more space within her own community to have that kind of power and knowledge.
And so we've been talking about the 19th century. Let's move to today. Tell us about some of the main characters today, especially the two mothers. There's Rebecca, and we have to say a lot of the names of the local people of Vanuatu are biblical, you know, so you can tell the continuing influence. The missionaries were successful to some degree. And tell us about Rebecca and Michelle. They're really twinned in some way. I mean, they both recently lost their sons.
Yeah, so Michelle is the mother from Toronto, and her son, who was about 12, like maybe a little bit younger, had drowned in the family's pool the sort of year before our events take place. And she is still very deeply mired in her grief. Her family life is falling apart. She's kind of not even very present for the rest of her family, particularly for her son, Zach, who we spend a lot of time with in the book. And she gets this call from this place, this fictional island in Vanuatu. And she thinks of this as a reaching for a last ditch hope that maybe somehow taking her family to this place can help them, help her get better in some way. And then on the other side, we have Rebecca, who's a young mother from Vanuatu, whose infant son dies after a terrible cyclone hits the island, and he becomes ill and dies sort of for lack of clean water and lack of medicine and the kinds of things that unfortunately plague a lot of the more rural areas, and especially as climate change continues to cause these crazily huge storms. And her son's death is sort of what sparks her husband reaching out to the family from Toronto. But they're both in their grief. But I also wanted to look at how they dealt with their grief differently. Michelle holds her grief very close and very tight and very privately, which I think is something we tend to do in North America, that we don't tend to express our grief in big ways or even very much in community ways. We like package it up and like want people to kind of get over it and that kind of thing. And
more white people, you would say, in North America.
Yeah, yeah. It's like Western, I think it's like, it's very European sort of Western tradition. We've kind of isolated death away from us, I think, and the process of grieving. And we want to like medicalize it, and like have particular ways to do it. And so the white family, the Toronto family, who are called the Stuarts, they're all kind of in their like kind of individual silos of grief, and they're not talking to each other and they're not sharing it. And to the degree that, you know, Zach barely wants to speak his brother's name in front of his mom because she always reacts so terribly. And on the other side, we have Rebecca and her family who are mourning their son, but it's a much more communal sharing of the mourning, that their son was part of his family, but also this larger community. And they talk about him a lot, and he's much more present for them in a way. And it's not that they're not brokenhearted and grieving it, but they also, they talk about him and they remember how he would laugh, and they remember these like really wonderful things, and they share that with each other. And Michelle is sort of like, in particular, still like strapped into her isolated grief. And so it was just a way to think about not just culturally how different peoples deal with grief, but also how different individuals deal with grief. And is there not a better or worse way, but yeah, what are the ways that we can handle it? And then that kind of allowed sort of lots of other conversations, allowed these two women to kind of find their way towards each other or push back against each other, because they don't quite understand how the other one can be behaving the way that they are. And then they form a kind of relationship throughout the course, a not uncomplicated relationship, but they do form a relationship over the course of the novel.
And this notion of, you know, the different ways that the two families deal with grief is echoed in the plot that drives the novel, The Sea Between Two Shores, and I'm speaking with the author, Tanis Rideout, that drives it forward, and that is a reconciliation ceremony that is called by Rebecca's husband, David, one of the people from Vanuatu. So the difference, I mean, here's a reconciliation ceremony in a way. David is hoping to have some way to reconcile the two families, and he is taking responsibility or talking about the obligation of the Vanuatans to this family because they had killed a family member. But of course, it ends up being a lot more complicated than that. Yeah. Maybe at least two ways, the sense of obligation and responsibility. But talk about the Vanuatu cultural importance of obligation and responsibility and the contrast to Western notions of individualism.
Yeah, I found it so interesting. And I don't know that I fully grasp it or will ever grasp it, having grown up in, you know, North American Western culture, where we are very much about individualism and being obligated to somebody feels like a bad thing. You want to like clear that obligation as quickly as you can. You don't want to like be in debt to somebody. And the notion there that like it is a more communal sort of sense. People are obligated. Obligation is what ties you to people. It proves in some ways your connections, that if you're obligated to somebody, it's because they did something or gave something to you. And they would only do that if it to indicate like the connections and these kind of like webs of obligation between individuals and between families. And I think it's easy to like think of it as a like balancing of scales, or like there's like a scorecard or something, but I don't think it is like that. I think it's more this like reciprocity is maybe a better word to use than obligation, of this like continual cycling of gifts and parties and dinners and all of these things. Like if I host a big dinner for, you know, a bunch of people in my village, then somebody else has to do that next. And it's like this kind of passing on of responsibility, but also of a sharing of all of that responsibility. And I think that extends to these ideas of like grief and setting that against our way of doing things, which is like, I'm going to take care of me and like maybe my immediate family and like, that's it. And it, you know, you've got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and all that sort of thing. And not quite having the same sort of communal obligations and ideas of keeping everybody else in mind when we make choices. It is something I still contemplate because it is so foreign, a way of thinking that I'm not sure that I'll ever 100% understand it, let alone like kind of feel it as internally as people from communities like that.
And yet, of course, we are all in this together. We are on the same planet together. And in fact, you know, it is our penchant, the Western penchant, and particularly the corporate penchant for, you know, the ideology of every man for himself, that is dooming people from Vanuatu to the eradication of their homeland from sea level rise driven by climate change, where they have done nothing to bring that about.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such a huge thing. And Vanuatu has been on the forefront of sort of trying to bring awareness to this. They had taken a court case to the UN demanding that the, you know, the West there or all the sort of corporatized nations be held responsible for the damage that is being done. And it was approved by the UN. Like that doesn't, like there's no like legal enforcement to that, but at least it's something that's being talked about, and you know, hopefully some movements can be taken. There's another nation that's not very far from Vanuatu called Tuvalu, and at the moment they're trying to make a digital record of essentially their entire culture and country, because their islands are going to disappear. There's almost no way to prevent that at this point in time. So they're trying to become the first fully digital country before it happens. And it's just astounding. There was an article in The Guardian not very long ago, and there was a photograph with it of, I believe, the president of Tuvalu, and I do not know his name, unfortunately. And the photo, he's giving his talk from a podium set in the ocean, and the ocean is like almost up to his waist, to indicate this is how quickly this is happening. And it's such a striking photo, and we can reverse this, but even if we like do all the things we need to do, Tuvalu is going to disappear. And they're a tiny little nation in the middle of the ocean. They did not do this. And so it's like, it is this ongoing sort of environmental colonialism and this ongoing destruction to these places that for a while we have thought like, oh, colonialism is gone and we're like doing better. And here's just another way it's continuing on. And it's really devastating to realize that, yeah, these places are going to be gone.
And your book very much is concerned with the question of what people owe each other and the responsibilities and the obligations that we have that are so necessary to our survival. The novel is The Sea Between Two Shores. Thank you so much, Tanis Raita, for talking with Writer's Voice about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
In addition to The Sea Between Two Shores, Tanis Rideout is the author of the best-selling novel, Above All Things, and the poetry volume, Arguments with the Lake. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.